UCR podcast.
Replacements fans, you might be aware that there is a cool box set coming out in November for Let It Be, and I got an amazing opportunity to speak with the band's drummer, Chris Mars. It was so much fun to get together with him late on a Thursday night to talk about a bunch of different things, from Golden Smog to his art, life before, during, and after the Replacements, Iggy Pop, Johnny Thunders. Oh, man, it was a really, really great hang. And while it was fairly freeform, I sketched out a long list of things I wanted to talk with Chris about. And while we got to a good amount of those topics, the conversation also went to a lot of other places. And as you're probably aware, those are some of the best ones, the chats that just go where they go. And within all that, as you're going to hear, it was fun at times to just talk with Chris Mars, the music fan. Now, if you dig today's chat with Chris, I'd highly recommend, from one music nerd to another, another interview that he did back in 2023 that I listened to after we spoke, and I was continuing to go down the rabbit hole. He chatted with the Turned Out of Punk podcast back in 2023, and if you don't have that podcast on your radar, that's another good one, so check that out. The Replacements Let It Be box set is available for pre-order now wherever you get your music. It's out November 21st on vinyl, CD, and streaming, and it's a really great set. You can keep up with what Chris has going on. He's on Instagram at ChrisMarsArt and also has a website at ChrisMarsPublishing.com. Maybe this is your first time listening to the UCR podcast, and if that's the case, follow us so that you will get future episodes of the podcast as they are released. Our recent ones include Warren Haynes talking about a bunch of things, including his love for Aerosmith. And we also spoke with Def Leppard's Joe Elliott about being a fan of Bad Company, Mott the Hoople, and Free. So we've had some really great music fan-centric episodes lately that you might want to catch up on. And of course, whether it's Bad Company, Aerosmith, The Replacements, or whoever your favorite band or artist might be, we are writing about them every single day at ultimateclassicrock.com, so make sure and spend some time with us. Here is our conversation with Chris Mars of The Replacements. Enjoy it. As we kind of dig through things, before I get too far down the track, I do want to just talk a little bit, because some of the early stuff that I really gravitated to you know, outside of Replacements, was the stuff that you did with Golden Smog. And
oh yeah,
Minneapolis has always seemed like an area where musically you can fall into or drift into certain things, and the whole Golden Smog thing seems like it was taking shape for a while. Like, how did you get wrapped into it?
Oh yeah, that was just kind of a thing. I was kind of, the band had moved on for me at that point, and I was kind of banging around, and I hadn't done any of my solo stuff yet, you know, and somehow I got signed to a label and I was able to do some records on a label. I don't know how that happened, but it worked out. But so kind of in between there, you know, I got approached by Danny Murphy from Soul Asylum, and he, you know, just said, hey, you know, we're kind of throwing together this thing for fun. And a roadie of the Replacements was always also involved a little bit. So we just kind of got together but doing covers. I said, that sounds kind of fun, you know, and it turned out pretty decently. I think I hadn't heard it in a long time, and my brother put it on. He didn't quite know what it was. He goes, I think this is like, what, weren't you in this band? And he didn't say, he put it on, and I hadn't heard it probably for 10 years. And I was like, God, those fucking drums kind of sound pretty good. You know, the whole band sounded really good, you know, and it was like, wow, that, you know, that we did a pretty decent job on that. So it held up, I guess, in retrospect. So,
yeah. And I kind of, you know, I was thinking,
that sounded, sure, sort of sounds like how I would do the drums, you know, and then, oh, that is me. Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. The thing that kind of made me think about that, it was kind of loosely connected to talking to you, but obviously Bad Company got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this past weekend.
And, oh, yeah. Cool.
And it was interesting because I came up as a music fan. I grew up in the 80s, but really I think was kind of coming of age as a music fan, like late 80s into the 90s, at a time when Paul Rodgers was not with Bad Company. So the Bad Company that I was hearing was a very different Bad Company, different lead singer, Brian Howe. And these days, it's the Bad Company that folks do not think too fondly of. So I did not grow up with all those legendary Bad Company records in my head. And so right around the time that I was kind of getting into that legendary Bad Company stuff was when I heard that version that you guys did of Shooting Star. So it was kind of interesting timing that as I'm starting to get into that era of the band, I hear what you guys are doing. And the thing that like just kind of struck me thinking about it over the weekend as I was, you know, getting ready to talk to you was like, just using that song as an example, the Bad Company stuff seems like it would be fun stuff to play.
Absolutely. I think as a band with the Replacements, we were weaned on that kind of music, you know, growing, listening in the 70s as kids. We all had an affinity to it. For sure, Bob Stinson, me and Paul Westerberg, we were a little older. So we might, you know, than Tommy. But, you know, Tommy was I'm sure, listening to a lot of that too. But it was like Alice Cooper, Aerosmith, Bad Company. You know, all this stuff was just constantly played on the top 40 stations as kids. And so that gets in your blood. I mean, there's no way you can really get that out. And then punk kind of comes along and you feel everything changing. And when we, you know, went down that road, it was still always there. And I think that was why we would get bored sometimes with our stuff or kind of even maybe with the genre that we were part of. And we'd whip out like a Kiss song or, because it was fun and it was really nostalgic for us, and it was really fun to kind of try to play it with our limited ability. So we would have fun with that. But yeah, no, definitely all that stuff is part of the DNA.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like lost on people these days when it's like you've got access to YouTube and everything. But that's something that I like was familiar with bands, was that there was a time where it's like basically just keeping yourself entertained out on the road, you would start challenging each other. Like, let's learn these Kiss songs, or let's learn these whatever songs, like just to kind of like challenge each other and mess with each other. I bet you can't play with this, you know, like, let's see if you can learn how to play this. So there was that, like, there was almost kind of like a competitive element to it as well sometimes.
Right. I remember one distinct thing. We tried to do Saturday Night's All Right for Fightin', you know, the Elton John or whatever. And we thought, that's just kind of we could whip that up. And the chords were so difficult for the guys. There's a lot of weird little chord changes in there that they didn't anticipate. So we couldn't get it. You know, we fucked that one up over and over. But, you know, what was it? Thin Lizzy. I think there's some Thin Lizzy on the Golden Smog stuff too. So yeah, I just remember when The Boys Are Back in Town came on the radio for the first time. It's like, whoa, this sounds... It almost sounded a little kind of like getting towards punk a little, you know, and it's something was different there. And Alice Cooper, I think, also toyed with some of that stuff where it felt almost like leading into punk.
Absolutely. And like Alice Cooper, and as you mentioned, like Thin Lizzy, like you hear a song like The Boys Are Back in Town, it's like you hear that and it's like those guys sound cool. And like, so as like an aspiring musician, you're like, man, if I could be even a tenth as cool as those guys, that would probably be pretty all right.
Absolutely. And I remember going to like a lot of the shows way back in the day when we were whatever, 15 or 16, and it was Ted Nugent, Aerosmith, Alice Cooper, you know, all of those bands at the big arena. And it was always that, like, you know, well, I could never do that. They were up on a pedestal. They were too big. But then punk came along and it brought it all down and boiled it down into this, the Ramones, you know, hey, maybe I can do something like this. And so it was good. It was great that that genre did kind of open up things and maybe make people, you know, convince kids that didn't think they had much talent that you could actually maybe get enough chops to do something like that. And it was interesting because we struggled at first and honed our skills in that genre, but then we inevitably, by playing so much and so many tours, we got better. So it's almost like, hey, man, now maybe we are as good as some of those bands we never thought we could reach. So it's kind of cool.
You're right. I mean, punk certainly did open an interesting door for a lot of people, just as far as like opening up the I can do this kind of thoughts. But with hindsight, if you look at all those bands that you were seeing before that, like an Aerosmith and like their drummer, Joey Kramer, you know, all those various folks, I think that, you know, Nugent obviously had Tommy Aldridge at some point. Like there were some pretty incredible drummers. Like with hindsight, like, can you see how some of that stuff contributed in the long run to what you did?
Absolutely. 100%. You know, and to this day, when I put on, you know, Led Zeppelin, I mean, come on, John Bonham, it's like, forget it. You know, the guy's a master, and he came from, you know, he's from a different school, a different age, where he was kind of, you know, almost maybe probably weaned a little bit on jazz. So the way he could dynamically be a little soft and then just bang, And he had that ability, you know, when they would do those, some of those long blues numbers, and they'd get really quiet and then they just explode, you know, the just precursors of all the metal and all the stuff. And so, yeah, but I mean, yeah, that, you know, that would be something that would be like a, something I would really be reaching for that I never got. I mean, but at least maybe I could keep a beat and do something, you know, kind of mess around the edges there of it, but never be that good.
I think that John Bonham and Keith Moon are two examples of guys that came along at a time where there really weren't perceived rules. And because of that, it's like you could have guys like that that were just so interesting. But it's like you can kind of, again, tie that to the punk thing. It's just like if you can strip away in your mind like the idea that there's rules and a lane and a box that you need to be in, if you can strip all that away, like it, we see that now, certainly with all the various punk records that have become just absolute classics, that it really opens up your creativity in a way that can't be taught. And as you say, you guys like learned it in a really interesting way, because it's just like you literally were learning just by going out there and doing it and figuring that eventually we're going to get better at this, you know, which for some bands, it seems like more often than not, that probably worked out. And there's probably other bands you saw that like they didn't get better. They just kind of stayed where they were. But that's kind of what was interesting about the genre was that you could ultimately be sloppy like that forever, and it was kind of accepted because of the genre, or it's like you evolved. And certainly we, as we saw and as we know now, the Replacements were an example of bands of one of the bands that evolved.
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting the machinations that it went through. You know, you start out with the Ramones, Sex Pistols, some of that stuff, and then it got into the hardcore thing, you know, and then there was like the local band that we palled around with in the beginning. And then that whole hardcore scene going to, when that kicked off, that kind of stepped everything up as far as tempo. And then, you know, we made that, the record Stink, which was our attempt to kind of reach that, but we never got there really. But what that did was, is it did make you kind of like, you know, able to, you know, think about doing something at a high speed, and then, but then every hitting all of the big notes and doing it like, you know, on point, you know, kind of getting you couldn't really be sloppy. You could sort of be sloppy, but you also had to be right on in a lot of ways. So that up tempo, I think, kind of shaped us into where then when we slowed back down, it was a lot easier in a way to kind of, you know, stay tight and get rid of some of the slop. But it's always such a funny thing, because the Rolling Stones, the way Charlie Watts drummed, it was a little bit of sloppy. So I remember sometimes getting too tight and playing too much, and where you want to kind of loosen up a little bit, and especially in the studio when you're recording, you know, you can kind of rush things or be a little stiff. You got to be careful with that. So kind of trying, finding ways to get a little bit of that looseness and kind of back off it. So kind of an interesting thing. You get your chops down too much, and then you want to kind of back off.
Yeah, and I think it's real easy to have a producer knock you into shape and he's just like, knock that off. But otherwise, if we take the producer out of it, like what you're talking about there, how did you start to kind of, was it a producer, or how did you start to kind of realize and recognize the disciplines you kind of needed to expand or pull back? How do you start to kind of recognize some of those moments where it's just like, I'm doing too much of this, or I'm not doing enough of this?
Yeah, I think it comes from, you know, playing too many live shows and too many tours in a row. And, you know, and then the way I learned how to play was, I was a very hard hitting drummer. And I would turn my, I would saw the little beads off of my sticks, tape them up, and use the club handle of, you know, the club to hit the stick. And then I'd have to find skins that were extra thick, because I would go through too many skins. So it was like a very extra thick bass skin with a thing on it, you know, like a pad on it, so I wouldn't go through that. And then a really thick, you know, really heavy duty snare skin that would take the punishment of the butt end of the stick. And so I remember just like, you know, I would beat myself up. I had my snare at an angle to where when I'd hit it, I'd have kind of a rim shot a lot of times where they really pop that snare. And then it would be just at the, where my leg was, you know, I would hit my leg just a little bit, but I was so adrenalized that I didn't realize I was punching the hell out of myself. So I'd have these giant bruises at the end of each show. And it would, by the end of the tour, my leg was just all black and blue, but I, you know, it's just how I played. So when you learn how to play, and thanks to hardcore and punk, that made me play that way. You know, everything is on 10, everything is on 11, and you have to compete with the volume. So then trying to back off of that is a trick. And especially if you do tours in a row and you're, it's really hard to kind of, man, it's, that's why I really appreciate like a Charlie Watts or even a John Bonham who can go back and forth. And that was something I didn't do as effectively. Although I think when we did Please to Meet Me, we went down to Memphis and we were playing there and I think I got a little sick and I was taking a lot of cold medicine and that kind of like loosened me up and got me in a weird, and I don't know, maybe it was just the atmosphere of Memphis and we were working with Jim Dickinson who worked with the Stones. And so like, you know, all of that zeitgeist maybe is swirling around. And so then I kind of like, and then we were doing some blues numbers and I was kind of getting in a weird pocket in different ways that I didn't, with the cold medicine and all that kind of stuff. So you kind of learn little tricks along the way and say, you know, I can get there again if I want. So, you know, yeah, just different attitudes on how to approach it and how to get away from just a really rigid way of doing it and then backing off. So I think later on in the Replacements, I learned how to kind of go back and forth a little bit more. So
it's really interesting though, because I wonder, it seems like there are some guys that, it's just what they do. The thing that I always think of that I referenced pretty recently was when Stan Lynch had left Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and they got Dave Grohl to fill in for Saturday Night Live. And Dave Grohl sounded exactly like Dave Grohl playing with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
He's just a hard played, hitter.
So as soon as you said, as soon as you just pointed out that you're a hard hitting guy, like here's a hard hitting drummer in the context of the Heartbreakers that even if that had gone the distance and they had been like, Dave Grohl, come in and join the Heartbreakers. And he says yes, and he joins the Heartbreakers. It just wouldn't have been the same thing. Like, I really liked it. I really enjoyed seeing him play with the Heartbreakers on Saturday Night Live. But it was just such a contrast from the band that they were with Stan Lynch. So that's just something I think of, because there are just certain folks that to this day, anytime I see him play with somebody else, whether it's Queens of the Stone Age or whoever it is, he is one of those guys, and I think that Kenny Aronoff is another guy, but there's lots of guys that we could name off that they are what they are, and there's – you hear musicians say it sometimes that they've been brought in to do a session and the producer or the band doesn't like what they came in and did, and it's like – they're like, well, why did you bring me in? Because – you know, this is what I do. Whether it's a guitar player or a bass player, there are certain people, as you know, Chris, that it's just so stamped into what they do that even if they – I think Dave Grohl is a very creative person, but at the end of the day, he has a certain thing that he brings that is going to be stamped into what he does, and that's something that is true for so many people in the business that do what you do.
Yeah. I think that's true. The cast, the die gets cast, and you know, you got to kind of work at if you want to get around that sometimes, you know. Yeah, it's a little difficult, but yeah, no, it's a good point.
Going to Memphis, man, that seems like this is something else that I've been talking about with folks lately, but it's just interesting. I think the way the environment or a studio stamps itself into the record, like how much did you see that happen when you guys went to Memphis as far as what came out? How much did Memphis get into what you guys did there?
I you know, I don't know so much if it was the studio, but it was definitely Dickinson and some of his stories. And then kind of in between recording, going out on the town a bit, like maybe a day off and seeing a lot of like Memphis jazz, jazz guys and different things like that. And, you know, it's just a different atmosphere. You're kind of surrounded by, just kind of a different feel down there, and it's a culture. Every place in the country kind of has its own little bit of a culture. So you know, you're down there for like 3 weeks or whatever doing something, and you kind of you kind of went in Rome, you know, you kind of meld in, and at least I did a little bit. But, you know, I think also it was a very interesting time for us where, cause Bob Stinson was not in the band and it was a 3-piece.
Yeah.
And it's like me and my wife always talk about this, where she kind of actually pointed out, if you look at bands that are essentially 3-piece bands, Rush, even the Police, well, the Police are, but, like even Led Zeppelin, which are, you know, you got a
sure. singer,
but you got, so when you have that, you got busier bass, you got a lot of guitar, the Who, I mean, look at Keith Moon. So you got a lot of more fill going on. And I think maybe that came into effect a little bit for us down there, cause it was more of like a 3-piece, and instead of a 4-piece, there was that something that was a little missing that we kind of had to fill in the void. So that was also part of that.
Yeah. I think it's the reverse of, obviously, if you go from being a trio to being a quartet or a quintet, first of all, a lot of times the fans cry foul. They're like, you're Rush. You don't need to add a fourth person. Rush is meant to be 3 people. Same thing with Cream, any of these bands we want to throw out.
Yeah.
But that has to be interesting, the reverse of that, going from, as you say, having X number of people down to really being a trio. Because trios are so locked in because mm-hmm. there's more space to fill, that had to be pretty interesting to go that route just from a recording perspective.
Yeah, it was. And I think another element to that was, I remember reading an interview with Charlie Watts, and he said, you know, most drummers are playing with the bass player. That's kind of like, you know, there's a lot of that goes on. Not everybody, but by and large, that's, I think, kind of how it works out. And I didn't know that. And I read an interview with Charlie Watts, who said he always plays with Keith Richards. He's not listening to the bass. And so I did me and Bob Stinson were the first two guys before anybody else, really. There were some other guys in the band, but we learned how to play together. And Bob Stinson had a great sense of rhythm. He could jump on the drums if he wanted, and he could do stuff. He had a really great sense of rhythm. And so we played together very well. So I just learned that way. And then Tommy came along, and he's obviously a great, great bass player too, and got better and better, like we always all did. But so going into Memphis, that was a big thing that was missing for me. And I had to kind of like, I remember trying to wrestle with that. And I was almost like, I had to sort of get in my own rhythm world a little bit more. And hold up that end of it, because Bob wasn't there to, you know, to keep me, you know, we weren't there to keep each other on. And so that was, I remember being just psychologically another shift. I think the cold medicine helped me get around it. I really did.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there is the dynamic of any band, and Steven Tyler started out as a drummer. And when you know that, it really makes sense. His songwriting and his approach to the lyrics and the way he punctuates his vocals and stuff, it all makes more sense knowing that he started it as a drummer. So there's, I think, all these things that when you're getting into a band, there's what you know going into it, but then there's the stuff that you don't know about your fellow bandmates that finds its way into the mix as you all start to know each other, and you start to find out basically the secret powers that these people are bringing to what you do, that you had no idea that this guy is going to contribute this to this thing that we're trying to do.
Yeah, you don't. And it is like, it is, you know, like I record now, when I did my first solo record, I did everything on my own, and it was pretty much a kind of an extension of the mode I was in, you know? So it was a little bit of an extension with that. Although I was hungry for, you know, a little bit, you know, I don't know. We had changed kind of at the end of the Replacements, and I was kind of hungry for a little bit of more of the old days where there was melody structures and things like that. So, but I remember playing, you know what? I forgot what I was going to say about that. I am 65.
Sure.
So you can have a senior moment.
You can. Absolutely.
But maybe it'll come back as we're talking here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What gave you the confidence to go, I can make this solo record and do it all myself?
Because, I know what you were talking about too. You were talking about Steven Tyler and the rhythm,
sure.
sense of rhythm.
Yeah.
And what I was going to say is, now when I record now, I'm exploring some of that with guitar, because rather than just do the, you know, that on the bar chords on the chords or whatever, like messing with rhythms and two guitars doing two different things and offsetting each other and completely different than the drums. But it makes a lot of sense that Steven Tyler was that, because, and I don't know if I knew that actually, because yeah, like you said, he's rhythmic in his weird, like thing, the way he spits words out, you know, it almost gets a little rappy or a little rhythmic. So God, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, why not? If you know, if you're playing, and I think another absolute, I don't know if Jimmy Page had a lot of music ability from a very early age, but he was also rhythmically really weird and cool too, you know? And then with Bonham, I mean, just, you know, all of those guys were so great.
Well, look at John Paul Jones too. John Paul Jones could do 8 million things.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, just what a combination of people. Yeah. Just incredible. Incredible.
When chemistry. It came. Yeah. Oh yeah. When it came to like that initial solo record where you're like, I'm going to do this all myself. What gave you the confidence to do that? Because obviously it was a moment, I think, for some music fans when McCartney puts out his initial McCartney solo record where he played everything himself. Anytime somebody got into a record, whether it was hearing that McCartney record or whatever record it is where the person played and did everything, that's a really interesting thing to wrap your head around just as a music fan. But I think at a certain point, obviously you were evolved pretty far at this point, but at a certain point as a musician, that would have been a lot to wrap your head around and go, I don't know if I can pull this off. Because the thing that's interesting is there's the idea that, yes, you can go in and do that, but making it sound like it's not just one guy playing everything, there's an art to that.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, I was incredibly afraid. I was like, you know, I was like, oh shit, I can't, you know, what? I got a record deal. I get to go in the studio. I didn't know if my songs were going to hold out. I never sang before. I was just like, holy shit. But you know, you get in there and you just start to drill down on stuff. And then you start to actually surprise yourself a little bit. Oh, you know, I guess I can kind of play a lead guitar. It's maybe a little simplistic, like Neil Young or something, but hey, you know, there's something going on. And then I think it is like what we were talking about earlier with the sense of rhythm. If you're a drummer and you're trying to do these other things, I mean, you can get in between chords and do stuff rhythmically on the guitar. And so I think all of that, you know, I think maybe it helped to be a drummer to try to do all of that stuff as well. But yeah, a lot of it was just sheer fear, you know?
Oh yeah. One of the reasons we're talking is there's the new box set coming out for Let It Be next month, it seems like with hindsight, like that was an interesting turning point as far as the continuing evolution of the band. Like, what are the things that kind of stick with you about that album in that time period?
It's, man, now we're talking about over 40 years ago. If we can,
yes,
just amazing. It's amazing. But you know, I can think back and I can kind of put myself right there. And I think the reason I can is it because going into the studio was always the most fun for me. That was the most fun aspect. I enjoyed touring when we were younger. As we got older, I didn't really like it anymore, but I always liked getting the creative aspects. And, you know, and what I do now, I'm a painter and I'm doing things creatively all the time. And I don't have to leave the house. I can just, you know, go for that. So the studio was always the most fun for me. The first part of it was like, you know, as a band, kind of working the songs out and working the arrangements and the stops and all that kind of stuff and the dynamics of the song. And then going into the studio was that next level of like, well, now we're going to see, you know, what it sounded like in the practice space. And now we're going to see what it sounds like on tape and just hearing that come together and being surprised. So I think it's always that way with any record, but with Let It Be, I think it was good because we were touring very extensively before. So we had our chops down. I mean, we were ready to go and that's not always the case in the studio. Sometimes you can be off for a month and then you're rusty and you got to kind of get back in the groove. So we were hot off the touring and we went in. So that was a really good thing. And I just remember really being concerned about, like, I wanted to just, you know, there was a punchiness that I wanted to hear. So I remember kind of sneaking, you know, around by the producer and kind of just pushing my snare up a little bit on the board and, you know, maybe a little more kick, you know, trying to like, maybe you won't notice it, you know, just like, just a little bit more. Cause I wanted to hear that punch. And, you know, just kind of all of us being in, it was in a Blackberry Way in Dinkytown and here in Minneapolis. And so it was kind of fun to get back there. That's kind of where we started recording, and that's where we then we went away from it, and then we went back there. So it was kind of fun. Very small little room, but it was a great time. And it's always so much fun to get in the studio. And at that time too, the technology isn't where it is today, and you had to have a studio. You had to go in and you had to have the fat tape, and it was all analog. There was no digital anything at that point. So you were really reliant on having to go in and book that studio time again. So you wanted to make the most of it. But it was fun. It was a blast. Yeah.
How much was there a feeling with hindsight? How much was there a feeling that there was a aim to evolve? I think you're always looking to push the envelope as a band with every record you make. Unless you're AC/DC, and I'm not saying that as a bash, but it's like clearly those guys had a format that worked very well for them. They are not necessarily the norm. There's a lot of bands out there that they were continually, I think, evolving naturally, but also just as you write more songs, you get better at writing songs and so on. Like, it all kind of happens, but sometimes it feels like there's a real conscious effort that here's what we did with the last record, with the last two records. Now with this one, here's kind of where my head's at. So what was kind of driving where you all were at collectively in headspace-wise with where you all went with the material on this record?
I think the two records back was Stink. So that was kind of our attempt to go into this hardcore world that we didn't quite reach. But, you know, I still really like that record. So after that, that was an attitude. And then after that, we were kind of like, you know, we don't really fit with that. Where do we fit? And we were even kind of exploring going away from some of the punk roots. And then Hootenanny was the next record, which was just kind of all over the place. You know, it had some sort of jazzy, just kooky shit on that record. And, you know, but then some really, you know, sort of standards the way we would do a song. But so I think because that was a little more eclectic, we were working on, you know, Paul was presenting songs and we were working them live. And so, and then again, coming off the tour and sort of having them, you know, our chops on top of them. There was probably just a different attitude where we're probably not going to make, it's not going to be as eclectic. And, you know, we're going to go in with a little bit of a different attitude. We were all feeling like, you know, like more edgy, more tight. And I think it's reflective, I think, on that record.
What's it been like for you? There's been these box sets coming on sort of an ongoing basis, but if we just look at this Let It Be one as an example, what's it been like for you going back to this particular era and this material?
I had to think, because it's so long ago now, I had to think for a second, where did Hootenanny come after this one, or was this before? Just which one came before which? So, you know, with life, you get on to doing other things. And for, you know, you just like, you're immersed in these other things. And so you do have to kind of remind yourself, but I think what it does is when you look at what any record I look at, it sort of puts me back into the sort of the very, and when you're younger, you know, time is more stretched out. You know, you get older and everything goes by faster. So when you're younger, like a year or two can seem a little bit more long, a little longer than it does when you're 60, you know, a year is like, woo, it just goes by. So I think, you know, we're starting out with Sorry Ma, and then we're doing these records like each year or whatever, but you can sort of remember your kind of where you were and how you were growing as a musician and how we were growing as a group and how we were getting better and in certain ways. And so if I look at that particular record, I can kind of remember kind of where we were on, you know, how we could play live, you know, and how we could maybe do things a little differently in the studio. And then the next one we did, I think, was Tim, right? Is that it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Yep.
And that one, I was hoping that, see, I wanted to hear you know, again, I wanted that to be, there was a couple songs that I just wanted to just blast out. And I thought, I just always was unhappy with the production of that record. I never liked it. And it's what everybody is familiar with. So I get that. But when they remastered that, when I heard it again, and it's like, now I can hear things. That's the way it always should have sounded to me. So I was really happy with how they took it and remixed it. So it's it's good to know that it's all on tape, you know, and I think there's some remixing going on with this one as well. I think I haven't gotten a copy yet, so I don't know.
I think the it's interesting you mentioned the remix of Tim, because that's one of the times recently, yeah, you know, past several years, that I can just think about how much hubbub that caused, the fact that it had been remixed and stuff. And it was interesting to me because I think that the conversation that I got into a few times was, you know, they haven't taken the old version of Tim and made it so you can't ever find it again. So, and this, and the Replacements are not the first band. Remixes have actually become kind of a thing, certainly over the past decade, if not the past 20 years. I understand, because in this age of streaming and stuff like that, there are situations where sometimes they will, a band will sometimes take a version of the album and they will straight out replace it. So if you don't have the CD or the vinyl or whatever, you're SOL as far as hearing the version that you've always known. But yeah, it was just kind of funny with Tim, because I think at some point, I certainly saw it said a few different ways. Look, nobody's forcing you to listen to this remix. You can continue to listen to the version that you've always loved. I kind of, from my side of things as a music fan, I kind of love where we're at, that folks like you guys have the opportunity to, it's basically like fantasy football. You finally have the opportunity to go back and fix the things that you would have liked to have done differently. And obviously, like, if we look at the Star Wars movies, like, George Lucas made a lot of enemies by changing the Star Wars movies. But again, George Lucas, the reason is because he took the original version of the Star Wars movies. Those came out of circulation, so you couldn't watch them, you couldn't get them. But
yeah,
the way this is being done makes a lot of sense to me, because it gives you guys a chance to address things that, with hindsight, you wanted to address. Just generally, even if you like the record as it was, as you know, Chris, technology is better. Like, so there's a lot of toys and stuff that are at your disposal as a band that just weren't there. And I think that what you all, and what a lot of musicians, the way musicians are, musicians like technology, they like messing with things, they like tinkering. So there's just all this stuff that, if you have the chance to kind of tinker with the stuff that you did, there's, why wouldn't you want to take that, like, ride?
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, as long as it doesn't turn out worse than the original, I mean, you know, you can explore it. But, you know, and you know, I really just, you know, I didn't know, I knew that it was being done, and I had no idea how it was going to turn out. And then when I heard it, it's like, oh, somebody kind of, like you said, they were probably able to use some of the new tools and bring certain things out, and, you know, and it's like, ah, man, this is sounding good. I really was pleased with it. It's interesting. There was a little tidbit I watched. It was like, you know, so you go down a little rabbit holes. Obviously, it's so easy to go down rabbit holes now. And so I went down a little bit of a Beatles rabbit hole, and there was a George Martin interview, like a little piece. And maybe you've seen it. Maybe a lot of it's, you know, a lot of it, but it, basically he was talking about how he went to visit John Lennon at the Dakota Building, and they were hanging out for an evening. And so they went back to John's apartment and they were talking. And then John expressed to George, or to George Martin, that, you know, he said, you know, I hate everything we did. I want to record everything over. And George Martin said, you got to be joking. He goes, no, really, I would love to just do it all over. And then he goes, well, but some of the things were great. Come on, George, like Strawberry Fields, you've got to like that. And he goes, no, he goes, especially Strawberry Fields.
Oh, wow.
But, like, you know, so, you know, as something, as I can do that with the things I create, I can look back and I can see what could have been different or that. But like you said, you know, things do get sort of cemented in people's brains and their ears a certain way. And, you know, and, but I don't have any qualms, as long as, like I said, if it doesn't turn out worse than the original.
And there's been situations where I can't come up with an example, but there's been situations where they tried remixing something, they didn't like it, so they didn't release it. So no harm, no foul.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, because the way you remember stuff, this will probably resonate with you. There are certain albums that to this day, when I hear them, because I heard them for the first time on an 8-track tape, you can remember exactly where the program clicked to go to the next channel. So there are these certain things, or the tape that wore out, the cassette tape that you, even if you hear it now on streaming or on CD, you still hear the part of the song in your brain where it was worn out and it had like a little bit of that tape warble. So yeah, there's these, it's interesting the way that the music just gets burned into our brain in that way.
It does. It's incredible. Yeah. And you know, certain things are produced at a time, whatever studio they're in, whatever mics they're using, you know, and then that sound is what you remember. And even if you hear like a live version of it, you're disappointed that it, you know, doesn't hit you the same way. I always thought like the Sex Pistols, never mind the Bollocks, had such a distinct guitar sound. And it to this day, if you hear it, you know it right away. And you know, whatever's going on there, I'm sure they weren't using any extraordinary equipment, but it was just, must have been the way they mic'd the damn amp, where it was in the tone, the room. But it has just this feel to it that, I don't know, man. It's to this day, it's just, oh yeah, that's the Sex Pistols.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. I was talking to Adria Petty, Tom Petty's daughter, recently about the Wildflowers album, which the thing that I was talking about with her was that's universally one of, if you're a Tom Petty fan, that's universally like one of their favorite records for a lot of people. A lot of people like that record. That's a short version. So what I told her was, you can't call that record underrated. But what I asked her was, I said, when it comes to that record, what are some aspects listening to that record that you feel like are perhaps underrated? So if we apply that to the Replacements catalog, I think that the catalog is pretty fairly universally loved. For you, what are some corners or moments that, now that you all have been so immersed in the music with the box sets and everything in recent years, what are some moments that you think people maybe don't notice as much that they should?
Wow. That's a really good question. I'm going to have to say that whatever we did, we must have done something, because sort of things keep growing, you know, and you know, it just keeps getting passed on. And so there's a, you know, a real decent cult following that's probably, I would imagine, quite a bit larger than when we were together. And so I don't really want, I guess I'm not going to question that too much, because whatever happened struck people in a certain way. And yeah. I'm going to look back and I'm going to say each record kind of had its own sound in its own way. And yeah. I don't think I would, I guess the only, you know, I would go the other way and say the one that I wasn't happy with was Tim, and now I'm much more happy with it. But, and a lot of people will probably disagree with that, but you know, I guess there's nothing that really sticks out that I'd really, you know, think like, hey, you should really dig into this and you'll find this here. You know, I think every rock has pretty been thoroughly overturned when it comes to us. So, yeah, I mean, some fans might be able to tell me what I missed. I don't know.
Yeah, let me know what I missed. Yeah.
What was that? There's been interviews that I've seen too. I think it was like a recent one with, you know, Paul McCartney or something. Like, he goes, you know, you tell me, you know more about this stuff than I do. You know, I can't quite remember, you know, so it's interesting.
You were talking about touring, and if we, well, I think about the thing that I think of a lot is, for example, Geddy Lee of Rush. Like, he's a baseball nut. So, A lot of what he did on tour revolved at times around going to ballparks and stuff like that. So what was kind of your thing that you were into while you were out on the road?
That's a good question. Wherever I could, I would go to museums, you know, and because I really, you know, I'm a painter now, a very traditional oil painter. So I was always, that was always something in the back of my head. It was a very mysterious art form. And whenever I'd go into a museum and I'd look at some of the great works, it was just mind blowing to me. And I had, it was something that came very natural to me as a kid. I was always drawing way before I could do anything musically. So it's the most natural thing that I can do actually, to this day. So, I would go to museums. I remember being in Paris and we broke down there, and the rest of the guys didn't have any interest in going to the museums or anything. And I just said, man, this is a good place to break down. So I just went around. I went to the Louvre. I went to all these different museums. And And so that was a thing that I would do to kind of keep, you know, the boredom away when we're, because on the road, it really truly is. It does. It's like hurry up and go. I mean, you do the show and it's exciting. You're doing the before show, after show. And then it's just like, you're fucking just sitting around and you're waiting. Yeah. You're in a van and it's hours. So you got to occupy yourself. But so, you know, reading, I guess a little bit, but also drawing, doing a lot of drawing. And then, like I said, visiting these places that may have a museum, you know, along the way. So it was fun.
So you had all that history of drawing. So that's an important thing to focus on. But what's kind of the spark that ultimately makes you pick up the paintbrush and take a crack at maybe I'm going to be a painter? How did that happen?
It was a very natural drawing ability. So I could always do that. From the time I was very like second grade, I remember I was in a Catholic school and the nuns pulled me aside and said, you need to go to the principal's office. And I thought I was in trouble. And when I got to the principal's office, the principal said, did you do this? And she showed a drawing that I had done in art class. And I said, yeah. And she was like encouraging me, like, you know, she said, this is very good. You know, I was like, whoa, I thought I was in trouble. And then I'm getting these, you know, accolades. So I had a very, natural ability. And so it's something that you can't really shut off. For me, I can't shut it off. I have to keep trying because my mind is geared that way. And I have, before I came up with the genre of work that I'm in right now, the sort of the low brow sort of expressionist, you know, figurative, it's pretty dark, kind of, a lot of people think it's kind of in a dark vein. But it was a vision that was there before I ever got to painting. It was something that I saw that I couldn't get out with drawing tools or pastels or anything I had tried before that. And so I knew I had to get to this place. And so I would always study, and it was all self-taught and just trial and error, a lot of frustration. By the time I was 40, I finally figured it out. So wow. I struggled after the replacements. I went headlong into it. I got very frustrated. I was very immersed, very transfixed by it. And I knew I could get there. I knew I was able to get there, but I wasn't entirely sure, but I just kept at it. And then I finally broke through right around age 40 and I was able to, then it was just like, woo, I get it now. I know how to do it. I could control the median. And I found my process, you know, with surface and paint. And so now I can just, you know, it's great. I can just get in there and I can just go now. So it's all, you know, all these technical aspects that are in the way. And then once you get past those technical aspects, then your vision can just, now that can just spill out because you already, you know how to get all the other things, you know, together. The paint, the color, the mixing, the composition, all of the things I struggled with. The line work, you know, the shading, the light, and there's a lot of elements that come into it. So, but it's a very traditional, there's a reason why it's a very old traditional medium. The oil and the paint and the way it reacts with light, if you put it under a light, it can just glow. And, so there's just, the medium is very rich and I could never get anything any other way than through oil paint. So I'm very thankful that I finally figured it out.
One of the most valuable things that somebody told me as far as writing goes was when you're struggling with something, step away, you know, take a break, go have dinner, go to bed, look at it in the morning, whatever the case is. So in that way for you, the classic line that we hear is, of course, the painter that burns the first how many ever paintings that they make, they set them on fire, they burn them. That's when you hear that as a kid, you're like, wow, the painter did that. But for you, how did you find your process? As because I've heard different things where sometimes people will just junk it and they'll move on to the next thing. Other times they will just put it to the side. They will start working on something, but they'll eventually come back to it and find their way and finish the thing. So everybody, obviously, again, like we've been talking about with music, everybody has their own process. How did you kind of find your process in way of working in a way that you're not going to drive yourself mad with this stuff?
There was a couple key things I think that happened when I was done with the band. I didn't have any income. I didn't know what to do, but I had these other skills. I can sculpt and I can draw. And so I have these visual skills and I go, well, you know, maybe I can make a little. So I went to work at a prop company. And so you'd get all these different jobs, you know, hey, you're sculpting a worm. Ah, now you're painting this big thing that looks like a roll of toilet paper, a giant roll, you know, whatever. There's just anything and everything. You don't know what you're going to get. So I would get thrown these and they'd always give me kind of the more creepy organic things, you know? So they were, you know, things that I could, you know, like, you know, worms and, you know, decayed trees and things like that, or bat wings, you know, there was some, whatever the ad was. And so they would call me in for these special things. But what I learned there, I thought, you know, I thought to myself, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this forever. The shop dogs in that field were there and they're lifers and that's what they do. It's their shop and that's cool and it's great and it's fun, you know, and you can have a lot of fun, but it can get tedious when you have, like, you know, people from the ad industry, like, that don't really know what they want, trying to tell you what they want and they can't explain it. So there's a lot of, like, communication problems that can happen in that field. But what happened was, is that I learned how to treat a surface with texture and different washes, and all of the things that I learned there went into the prepping of the way I prep a canvas now. So I have a certain amount of texture that I do with gesso, some color washes that I put on with acrylic, and then I go over that with varnish and then I paint into the varnish. So it's a pretty, the texture was the one thing that I learned there. And then the other thing that I learned was there's this giant artist handbook. It was this really thick thing. And I was looking for clues in that. And then I looked and I went to one little paragraph and it was in the oil painting section. And it said, try to, you know, varnish your surface first and let it dry and then paint into the varnish. And I thought, that's really fucking weird. You know? And I said, but I'm going to try that. And what happens is the varnish can be set up for a year or more, 2 years. And then when you apply the oil paint to it, it reactivates it. And then the paint goes into the varnish. And then you just get these really cool things. And I think if I look at, like, Da Vinci's work, I think that might have been how he did it, because it has this thick varnish and it looks like the paint kind of went into it and it has this dimension to it. So that those couple things, texture and then figuring out how to paint into varnish, everything just clicked at that point. So those were two very, very crucial things.
What are you still working to get better at in that regard, just as far as, like, everything you're doing? Like, what are you still, what's still the challenge that's in front of you that you're going, I'd love to figure this out?
I think I just released a book, 7:42 PM. It came out about a year ago. So it's about 15 years of my work, and you can get it through, I'll put in a plug, Rare Bird Publishing is putting it out.
Oh yeah. They're so good folks. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. And so, what I've done, what I've noticed in my work, and it kind of happens slowly, obviously, but every sort of technical hurdle that you get past opens the door for something, because you're more relaxed, it opens doors for something else you want to explore. And so what I really noticed of my exploration over the last, especially like over the last 7 or 8 years, was color, getting way more creative and more courageous with color, because color is a very odd thing. If you mix it the wrong way, it can get really garish and really ugly. And so you got to kind of, having a sense of color and getting more courageous with how I put colors together, you know, along with all the other elements, is definitely a place that I've gotten more comfortable with. And then I continue to want to kind of explore more, you know. So if you look at my first book, it has a palette to it. And then if you look at my second book, you'll see a shift. So you'll see, like, a lot more color happening.
Where'd you get the title for that newest book? That's a great title.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. It is the time of sunset on the fall equinox where we are in Minnesota. So that's
awesome.
And when I'm painting that kind of evening light, which I really just enjoy as the sun's kind of going down and things are getting dark, but things are kind of still glowing. And that's kind of how, that's what I go for when I'm painting. There's a warmth to it.
That's a great, super nerdy title. That's I never, ever would have guessed that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was going to call it Elemental, and we had the layout and everything. And then the Disney film came out, Elemental. It's like, yeah, right. Oh, shit. Got to change it. So
there's also the element of your painting that I know is related to your brother, and that's obviously we do as creative people, we're inspired by what is around us, but yeah. How did that develop to where you saw what you were doing was beneficial to him? And I would guess that it was probably beneficial to you as well. So it's like there's this interesting, both sides are benefiting from what you're doing, but how did you kind of discover that?
Yeah. And those are like, you know, to this point, I'm talking about a lot of technical aspects of painting. And then there's all of the emotional aspects of it. It's just a whole, it's like the other half of painting or creativity in any sense, really. And a lot of those, you know, feelings and emotions came with growing up with a brother who was schizophrenic, and he's not with us anymore. So for my whole life, me and my siblings, you know, would see him be very lucid and be there, and he was really funny, super smart. And then he would drift off, and then he would have to go to an institution, and he was our oldest brother. So at the time they didn't know so much about what was going on with him. Schizophrenia wasn't really like how it's known now and how the aspects of that disease itself. But so that's what he suffered from. And, you know, just knowing him and knowing who he was and how funny he was, and then knowing the stigma on the other side that people have, granted with mental illness, there can be, you know, there can be violent aspects of it, but my brother was not that. He was very, very sort of docile and just cool, you know? And, I get a little choked up even thinking about it, but, you know, I wanted to honor him, with my work. So yeah, that's kind of how that came about.
Well, I kind of love that aspect, Chris, because my wife and I were talking tonight about the Trans album by Neil Young, which I think is a very interesting record for a lot of people because, yeah. Well, Neil made a whole string of records, including Trans, that his label wishes that he would have done something different. But I kind of love that basically Neil had his son Ben that had cerebral palsy, and Ben was someone that did not talk. So the record inspirationally came out of a time where Neil was trying to figure out how to communicate with son. And that's so cool. that was kind of the Trans concept was just struggling with communication. That was an element of it. So as I was getting ready to talk to you, it just was kind of well-timed that she and I had been talking about that, because there are just always really interesting things that inspire what we do artistically, whatever it is that we do. That's what it was for Neil. You know, that's what it was for you. And it's just like, you just don't anticipate where the muse is going to come from sometimes. And also you just don't anticipate how the muse can ultimately benefit other people. You don't see that return side of it going back the other way sometimes when you're going in to create something.
Yeah, no, it is. And, you know, we're all just, you know, our life experience and what we pull in and whatever goes through our individual filters, our individual experiences. And then if you're creative anyway, like you said, you know, that's going to come out in a certain way, hopefully, you know. I think about, you know, I was already geared to get into a band that I got into because it was really kind of a group of misfit outsiders, you know, that's kind of how we felt. And punk rock itself was really about championing sort of the, you know, outside the mainstream, the outsider. So all of those things dispositionally seemed to be right in line to where, you know, I was going to go, at least for a part of my life, you know. So, and when you're young, you know, you maybe don't, your nervous energy is at a level where it's a good time to get into rock and roll, because you can, you know, spend that energy in that way, where you couldn't if you were 35 or 40. You're not going to be able to, we're not going to be able to do those early records, you know, at that age. So the timing is right. So you get into an art form that maybe is a little more immediate, but still feels kind of like the direction you want to go. And I think that was another aspect of punk that was very appealing. So, you know, it all times out the way it all times out. And then you get worn out from hitting the drums too much and, you know, whatever else happens in a band, you know, no band lasts forever. And then you go on to the next thing. So,
but the musician side,
I'm sorry, but you know, to keep that creative edge, you know, is, I'm thankful. I'm grateful that I was able to find another avenue to kind of put all that energy into. So I always think when I paint, especially I'm tapping into that same kind of mentality and there's an edge to it. And, I can't sit and do it for as long as I could when I was 50 or 40 or whatever, but it's still there. I still enjoy it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, was how the musician side influences the painter side. What are the things that you see that kind of carried over? Certainly early on when we were talking about drumming and so on, we were talking about the discipline and all that kind of stuff. What are kind of the traits that with hindsight you can see that this is stuff that I kind of picked up on that side of things that it was helpful for me on the painting side of things?
Yeah, I think if with music, you know, it's interesting, before videos, you can probably relate to this too. You're listening to the radio or whatever you're listening to as a kid, you put on a record and you know, there can be colors and landscapes, you know, you can develop a picture around that song, and each song can kind of have a different vision. So I think there's a lot of sort of visual aspects that can come along with music. So in that sense, there's probably a relationship visually, you know, with melody and sonics and tone. And then you can kind of, you know, I think there's a similar vibe, I guess, that you can pick up on with painting, you know. And I make short films too, and that's like a whole nother sort of mindset.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, for me, you know, it's a good thing to keep fresh and to keep saying is to kind of jump around between these things. I think if I did one thing, I would get bored with it, and then I might get a little burned out or jaded. So I tend to just like, okay, I'm going to do this for a solid 3 weeks. And then I'm going to maybe do a little animation, and there I'm going to maybe write a few songs. And then they're just such different disciplines. You're working with technology, and it's very unorganic in a lot of ways, you know, not that music can't be very organic if you're playing with, you know, on acoustic guitar with another person and you're in the same room, but I don't really do that anymore. So I'm exploring these things technologically. And so with the headaches that come with that, I'm always very hungry to get back to the canvas and the organic nature of just dipping in paint. And it's very direct, it's very immediate, and it's just, you know, and it comes the most natural to me. But I do think doing these other things makes me appreciate it more, if that makes any sense.
It makes total sense. And I'm glad you mentioned the film stuff, because I wondered, like, how analog are you? There's something where technology evolves 100 miles every time you blink.
With
what you got access to film-wise. So how much have you taken advantage of that, and how much are you kind of just rooted in you like the way you pursue something when it comes to film?
Yeah, I think with the film, it's a few programs that are kind of older. I just learned a new one, but I've learned the programs that I use, you know, I've known them now for a few decades, and then I just kind of get into the animation program that I have that I landed on. I tried a bunch of different ones before I landed on the one I have, because it's the most immediate, and it's the one that if I can get in there and get something done fairly quickly, that's kind of what I like, and still get a decent look. So, you know, there's a lot of compositing going on. There's video camera, and then there's 3D animation that I can composite sometimes with the video footage, and or I can go the other way. And then, you know, the aspects of putting sound to that or coming up with characters, it gets really theatrical, but the technology does allow these programs now are so extensive, and you can just composite things so nicely now. I mean, I look at some of the old like Harryhausen movies, and I see like, wow, like those were just so, I remember growing up and watching those and the animation and how he melded that animation with live action. And it had all the acting that had to go. And they're still doing those things to this day, but it's really different. But when I look at that now, you can see the king on the green screen. But you didn't see that when you're a kid. It was like, whoa, this is really fucking awesome. And it was completely groundbreaking at the time. But now you can just, anybody now can get in on a computer that's not that big, and you can get all of these composites that are just really smooth and cool looking. And so it's just, the technology is amazing. And now it's weird though with AI, you know, now you can just kind of type shit. I think people are going to get more and more lazy. I am actually a little bit lazy, but because I use these things, like I said, I want to get in and I want to get something done fast. Otherwise I get too frustrated with the technology, and I just, I want to get away from it. So it has to have a certain immediacy, but so there's a laziness to that. I'm finding things that work fast and work decently. But now if you can just type it up, that's a whole, I don't know, man, that's a whole nother dimension. I don't think it's going to be, I don't know where that's going to go. What do you think about that?
I think it's pretty crazy, because there's pros and cons like there is to anything. There's been some AI elements that have been very helpful to things that I need to do, even with like audio or whatever it is. I think that there are things that can be used as a tool. I think that what you say is like the idea that people, well, that I think you're right when you say the whole laziness aspect of it. There's that danger that it almost takes the creativity and the desire for creativity. It sucks it completely out. And yet it's kind of interesting. The thing that I heard about today was that Pete Townsend of The Who was talking about how he's curious and would love to apply AI to some old songwriting ideas that he has, and maybe it could finish some things off. So I do think that something like that, that's being creative, you know? So I think that's being applied in the right way for a guy that the box set that he put out for the Who's Next album with the aborted like Lifehouse project. He had put out a box set back in the early 2000s called the Lifehouse Chronicles that had 60, 80, how many ever previously unreleased things. This Who's Next box set had 60, 80, how many more unreleased things that people.
Damn, so man. Very prolific dude. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a guy has so much material that it makes sense to me when you hear him say that. If you know the context of who he is as an artist, it makes total sense to me why. Because he's working against time, potentially. He's said in interviews that, look, I'm 80 or however old he is. He's like, there's less road ahead. There's more road behind. So he's seeing that. He's feeling that. And he's still this super creative guy that he's looking at that as a tool that I could use this to kind of make it more efficient, looking at all the stuff I've got and what I might be able to do with it. And so what I think when you look at it that way as more of a tool, I think that's totally fine. I just think it's pretty scary. You can't put your head in the sand, number one, but I think it's pretty scary some ways that it's like anything else. Some ways are pretty scary how it's being used, and other things you look at and you're like, oh, that's really kind of an interesting application for that. So I think there's, like anything, I think there's good and bad, Chris.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a double-edged sword. You know, so much of technology is a double-edged sword. And, you know, if you think about Pete Townsend in particular, with like Teenage Wasteland he was experimenting with that too. So he probably had an inclination for like, you know, messing with synthesizers and getting these weird, you know, arpeggios, you know, electronic arpeggios going, kind of playing on themselves and then doing something along with it. But it's so cool how he, you know, figured out how to meld those two things. But if you think about it, the Beatles, I think, probably set the template for all of that stuff. Did they ruin it for everybody? They probably did. Cause you know, here's an incredibly, you know, brilliant, creative band. It holds up to this day. And they were able to just say, fuck touring. We're just going to go in the studio and mess around. And then they had George Martin, who had all of these, you know, these ways of doing things with weird little sounds that they would put in and backwards tapes, and they wanted to explore all that. So mixing all of that and then still coming up with something that feels organic, I think is a trick. And so, like you said, if you can use AI and you can mix those things, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But if somebody is like trying to maybe is young and starting out and wants to just do it as a shortcut, then that's kind of dangerous, because then you're not gonna get those thousand hours that you need in on something. You know, what is the old saying? You got to at least put 1,000 hours, 10,000. I think it's like 10,000.
10,000. Yeah.
That's what it is. Yeah. And, you know, what the benefits of really honing in on something and putting in the time is, I don't know if you can replace that. So hopefully that won't deter people from really, you know, getting into the meat of something creatively.
It goes back to what you were saying about punk and the Beatles and the Who. They were kind of the original punks, if you think of it that way. The thing I was thinking about is you were talking about sounds, things that Pete was doing. I thought of two things. First thing is not necessarily related to the Who, but if you think about the person that at some point goes, I'm going to put the guitar instead of through a regular amp, I'm going to put it through a Leslie cabinet so it gets that Leslie sound.
Right.
That's cool. And one of the things I heard relatively recently that relates directly to The Who was the song Who Are You? They're like, if you think that that's a synthesizer at the beginning, what that actually is Pete took his guitar and ran it through an ARP synthesizer. So it's just like,
wow.
So and that's what made me think of that was when you were talking about the stuff that Pete did. Like Pete's an example of a guy that was constantly doing and I think that that's the punk element of it. And really, that's just the band element of it, if we get down to it, of just experimenting and trying things. And some things work and some things don't. But if it works in an interesting way, that's kind of the other thing that you're well aware of, is that now it's like there's plugins and all this kind of stuff that you don't have to experiment and you don't have to create the sounds that you used to have to create. But I think that's the better side is so yes, it's good to have plugins that you don't, if that vintage amp of yours blows up, you don't have to get another one shipped in from Pittsburgh. There's a plugin that can like at least maybe save your ass for the moment and replicate that. So that part's good, but I do think that it's beneficial, obviously, the way you guys had to do it back then, where it's like if you wanted a certain sound, there wasn't a plugin. You guys had to figure out how we're going to make that sound. To that end, I'll just throw that in. What's something that you recall you guys doing to create something that you were hearing in your head for the record that was a sound that you kind of had to create?
Wow. You know, I think there was a couple of things we were trying to do, like foot stomps, you know, or putting big long barrels on the end of the kick drum to get kind of a big boom. And, you know, there's, you know, certain little tricks like that, maybe that we toyed with, and some of them might have worked. But, you know, I a lot of that stuff was more, I think at that point, I was just really focused on, I want to get a good foundation for the rest of the guys to build the song on. You know, we all played together, but I wanted to, it was always like, let's get the drum track solid first. And then we can start to, you know, if the guitar or whatever needs to be overdone on top of that, maybe it's already there, maybe it's not, but at least you have a good foundation. So I was always really conscious about going in the studio and really getting that foundation first off, you know, so we could build upon that. But so, yeah, some of the more experimental things, you know, I think we're probably left up to producers and the different producers that we worked with that wanted to try those different things out. So a little bit beyond me, maybe in the studio, But now, I mean, like you said, it's so amazing. There's too many things. Do you record yourself? Do you do things in the, in the box? Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, it is incredible. Like we don't want to sell any products, but what is it? Native Instruments.
Yeah.
I mean, some of that stuff, come on, you know, it literally, when you hit it, it sounds like there's a giant amp in the next room if you got your headphones on. But it's too much. There's just too goddamn many choices to where you just kind of like, all right, let's pick an avenue here, you know?
Does that drive you crazy, though, that it's like you used to have to spend 3 days getting just a drum sound, and now it's like that has been extremely accelerated to where it doesn't seem like in the studio, doesn't seem like they have to spend that amount of time doing that anymore. And then there's, of course, the further bridge on that, which is they just record the drums, and it's like, oh, we're going to replace the drums anyway, so we can record them however they sound, and we're just going to replace it, which is so wrong in my book.
Oh, man, Yeah.
But for somebody like you, if we go back to just the amount of time that you would spend getting the right drum sound, that has to just make you a little bit crazy seeing how far that's come at this point. It's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's if you're recording on your own and you want a decent drum sound, hey man, like you said, it's a good use of technology to try to get an idea out and maybe to have a decent sound around it when you're doing something on your own. That's good. Yeah. And I, you know, when I, before all of these plugins, like you said, I tried to, on some of my solo stuff, I got a studio that was a little more, it was older school and it didn't have, you know, it was just like, it was digital, but it was to these linked up machines. And then I would mic the drums and I'd try to get a drum sound and I was fucking horrible at it. I just, you know, I couldn't, that's the hardest thing to get right, I think, is like a really fucking solid drum sound. You know, I didn't have the science in my head. I could mic an amp decently and that kind of thing, but there's tricks, man. There are some recording tricks, but yeah, with the plugins now and with the different things, you can just kind of dive in and it's cheating, but it's nice if you want to get an idea out. I would imagine for people working in that have a band, it's a good way to get a good skeleton and then present it to the band. And then like, hey, then let the organic nature of four or five guys or three guys or whatever it is, you know, start bashing it out. Cause there's just, there's no replacement for that. No pun intended.
Yeah, there was a point at one point where you said you just let it be. I'm like, going, there's a pun there too. I'm going to just hit you with a few other things and then we'll wrap.
Okay.
What's a good Prince story from your side? Seems likely that you must have a good Prince story.
There's a couple. When I did my first record, you know, it was at Paisley Park. So I recorded it there. I recorded my first two records on PolyGram at the time, which is now gone. But so I booked time there. And I said, hey, why not? You know, let's go. So I went into the, you know, it was like the C studio. So it was like the cheapest one, but it was cool because Prince was across the hall working on stuff at the time. So I was like, hey, I'd see him, you know? But you know, he's like, you know, obviously he was a man of very few words, but he came in and he listened to what I was doing a couple times. And that was kind of cool. You know, I said, whoa, you know, and he was kind of bopping his head a little bit. And he was actually really kind of down to earth, real nice. And then a couple times he would have chefs come in and bring food in for him while he was working. And we'd be working at the same time and maybe, you know, taking a break at a different time. We'd go out into the dressing room and he'd have leftovers waiting for us that he'd give us. I was like,
that's cool.
That's cool as hell, man. And so like, you know, we ate some really good food from his chef and you know, had a few words like, you know, really appreciate what you do, that kind of thing. But I mean, come on, he's just a world renowned fucking genius, you know, and I maybe didn't see it right off the bat, but you know, Purple Rain came out and then everything went crazy. And then right during that time, he was playing these impromptu shows at First Avenue in town. And I would I get a call from Maggie McPherson, who was connected, and she said, hey, you know, I got some tickets. You want to come? I said, fuck yeah. So I got to see about three or four shows. I think it was like four shows in the sound booth at First Avenue. And he was working out the whole thing before he went on a big tour. It was just fucking mind blowing. I mean, everything that he did was so meticulous, you know, the fucking lights, the smoke, the whole choreography, the sound. And then he's like jumping from one instrument to the other and he's flying all over the place. The whole is fucking nuts. I mean, the guys, you know, I don't think, I wonder sometimes if Minnesota appreciates him the way he should be appreciated. Ooh. I don't know. I don't sense that they do. I don't know why. Well, like when he died, they lit up the Eiffel Tower purple. I mean, he's the guy, you know. So, I mean, just one of those rare, talented fucking individuals that lived way too short, you know.
You talked about getting to like see some of those kind of tour rehearsal type shows. How often did you get a chance to do that, just generally, where it's like you would kind of go out and get to see some of your peers? Because so often, Chris, you're just doing what you're doing, you're touring, you're playing the shows. The Replacements worked hard. So yeah. How often did you find yourself in a situation where you got a chance to kind of go out and watch folks that did what you do their thing in a way that was interesting, to kind of see how the other half lives in that way, kind of the way you're describing getting to see Prince do his thing?
Yeah, I it was, you know, we would cross paths with people on the road sometimes, like, you know, hey, Iggy Pop is playing a show, you know, so we go down and see him, or, you know, Johnny Thunders, you know, is playing, you know, from the New York Dolls, and, you know,
oh, man,
go see him. And that was wild. That guy was a really fucking interesting guitar player. It was always like, he was doing some crazy shit. It's not, it was like a tornado on stage. It was just this weird sounds were coming. Yeah, he was all over the place. So it was quite fun. But yeah, you know, so those were, you know, instances that we had. There was like one really cool thing that we did was an awards show. And I think it might be on YouTube or something like that. But we went in and we, you know, had a dressing room, and then we shared the dressing room with Keith Richards, who was doing some stuff at the time. And then on the other side of our dressing room was Alice Cooper, you know, so then, you know, and then we go out, you know, and then there's like David Bowie's walking around, because he had like, I think, the Tin Machine, whatever that was at the time. And so it was just kind of like, whoa, you know, it was too much. You know, all of these kind of heroes were in one place at the time. You know, it was things like that. But then, yeah, like you said, you get to see them play, and you're not used to really doing that. Like you said, you're busy doing your thing. And so those instances were always really fun. I think also warming up people, like when we warmed up Tom Petty and we went on tour with him, and I never kind of grasped how massive. And I think that was kind of at the real height, like the Full Moon Fever thing. And so it was just, everybody was singing every word. And it was just this chorus, these giant audiences just singing along. And it made me realize, oh my God, this guy has like one hit after another. And I'd sort of, you know, fallen away from that a little bit. So it's pretty cool to have some of those experiences.
Was there something that you enjoyed about the Petty tour? Because I know that eventually Stan Lynch and Dan Barrett from Georgia Satellites, they've now done a couple albums together. But talking to those two guys, the moments when Georgia Satellites went out and, you know, played, as you said, you know, warmed up Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, there was more cross-pollination between the bands on that tour than it seems like there sometimes can be, where it's like sometimes, as you know, the opening band never sees the headliner the entire tour. The Petty scene seems like it was a different scene, like there was just more mingling than that.
I think there was, yeah. I mean, I remember some seeing Tom. It was interesting watching somebody at that level. He would sneak into our dressing room sometimes, you know, before the show. So it was like a kind of a cool sort of, hey, you know, there was a down-to-earthness about it, even though, you know, where Tom was at that point was pretty amazing. But it was an interesting window into that kind of fame, and which maybe I hadn't witnessed before, or wasn't really close to it, like on a day-to-day basis. And so there was like a sort of a routine where the guy would come to get him, to pull him in to talk to all of the people that he had to talk to before and after every show. And it was like a room full of like 25, 30 people that all wanted a piece of Tom. And it was a guy that had to come and find Tom and bring him in there. And you could see that he dreaded it. And so he would hide. and then he'd say, ah, shit, you know, is he there? And he would like, he'd be looking down the hall. Fuck. He goes, I think he saw me come in here. And then he'd knock on the door. Tom, we got to go. And he goes, all right. You know, so then he'd have to go do it. But you know, it was just like a kind of like an interesting thing, but yeah, I think it was, and I don't know if we were the right band to kind of fit with the Heartbreakers. I don't think the audience had a lot of, you know, I think, like, you know, you talk about maybe the Georgia Satellites or
there's more common ground.
Yeah. Lenny Kravitz, who also already kind of maybe had some hits going. So there's a little bit of I don't know, maybe a little bit of a more, they want to see him too. So I don't know. There was many people to see us on that tour.
But it's interesting because you're right. Being in a band, just generally, whatever level you're at, is exhausting, but you see the Tom Petty thing, and that gives you kind of an interesting window into, all right, what we do is pretty exhausting, but it could be that much more exhausting if we were at that level.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, just generally, like, overall, like, what do you appreciate looking at the whole of what the Replacements was and what the Replacements are at this point, legacy wise? What do you appreciate about what you guys did?
I think I appreciate the fact that we, like you said, we did work hard, you know, even though there was a laziness about us and maybe we didn't do every show the way we should have done. And we sloughed off in that way. And, you know, but I think generally when I look at it and, you know, the kind of the feeling that we wanted to put forth and, you know, I think we sort of nailed it in many respects. So, and it is like in retrospect, looking back at that time, it was a great way to spend that part of a life, you know, and, but again, it got to a point where there was a lot of downside too. And so it's like, I'm very appreciative of what we put out there. And I'm also really appreciative of what other people saw in us, you know, that maybe we didn't realize, and it kind of continues on. So whatever we did something right in that way. And we did strike a certain accord. So I'm very grateful that we did do that and gave something, you know, gave something to, we added to, you know, we put our drop in the bucket in that sense. Yeah, so I'm you know, I'm thankful and I'm proud of that. And it was some pretty crazy fun shit too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, I don't think anybody ever disputes. It was always clear that you guys had some fun while you guys were doing a good portion of what you guys did. So there's the overall entire arc of the Replacements and wherever things evolved to, but there's definitely a decent sized chunk of it that was like, those guys were having fun.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
And it's interesting, man, too, because you just don't think that you're going to be a band like that, that all these years later, even today, Chris Mars is still, somebody is hearing a Replacements thing, and what Chris Mars is doing on that record is inspiring them for what they want to do tomorrow. And there was obviously a time where it's just like, it was a more complicated thing to write a letter, put a stamp on it and hope it maybe gets to Chris Mars. Now, Chris Mars is a little bit more findable because of the internet and all that kind of stuff that I'm sure you've probably heard from some folks here and there that have shared some stories going, man, you know, I do this because of you. And that's gotta be pretty gratifying.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. It's any time that, you know, cause that's how we all start out, right? We're watching and we're listening, we're kids and we're inspired and it's art and it's fun, it's creative. And if you're that kind, if you're geared that way, you know, you're inspired. So if we could pass that on to anybody else, and which I think we have, and I have heard it gotten letters like that. And it's really, really nice to know that, hey, we could inspire somebody to pick up drums or guitar and a lot of times with the paint, you know, there's a lot of letters like that too, that, you know, that I'm very thankful of, that I can, you know, inspire anybody else to do that as well and kind of explore their own creativity. It's a cool thing. So
the thing I meant to ask about all the painting and films and stuff like that is I always love going down a rabbit hole with somebody like you. What are you kind of working on now? I think that'd be a good place to kind of like leave. You talked about the book you had come out a year ago, but where are you kind of at now? What are you happy about at this point? What's kind of, you know, feeding your enthusiasm?
Sure. So probably my number one thing, I have a show coming up at the Haven Gallery in New York City. That's going to be in the spring. So,
nice.
I'll be working, you know, through the winter on that, getting a collection of paintings. So that's kind of my number one thing that I'm jazzed about, but I'm also, I think what I've gotten good at, you know, we talk about switching back and forth between things. I used to be able to just have to burn something out before I could go on to another thing, but I've gotten better at like doing a little here and then doing a little here and then doing a little here. So what happens is I work on a piece of a film, I go back to painting, I maybe work on some songs. So I have like probably another record's worth of songs, and I have about 3 short films that are getting close to done. And then I've got, you know, so all of these things start to piece by piece. And then I put a bunch of stuff out at once and people think, well, how did you do all that? You know, but it's just, you know, it is being able to now go back and forth between different things. So yeah, I got, you know, got some films that are almost done, about 3 of them. And yeah, just working on stuff and bouncing around and keep trying to keep the those juices flowing as best I can. So.
Well, this is what we're going to put the period on, and that just is, you talked about Johnny Thunders. That sounded like it lived up to the hype. There's the whole never meet your heroes thing, but it seems like that worked out well. And here's what I want to close with. It sounds like, how much did Iggy Pop live up to the hype?
Oh, all the way. I mean, he's, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think so. There was actually, you know, we played with him earlier on when he
sure.
in small clubs, and then he started getting just playing bigger places. I have to admit, it was seeing him on a small stage in a small club and just going crazy. That was quite a bit better than seeing him on a big stage, but it was still cool. It was still cool.
He was at the Rock Hall inductions this past weekend, and man, he is still Iggy Pop. It's just incredible. That guy, you still, here in 2025, you still look at that guy and you're just tired looking at him.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Cool.
Well, Chris, man, thank you, man. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate you taking some time to talk about, you know, really all things Chris Mars, and just a blast to kind of dig through some stuff with you. So thank you for this, man.
I appreciate it. Thanks. It was a real fun interview. Thanks, Matt. Good to meet you.
All right, man.
Likewise. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.